first reading is from Joshua 3:10. The Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites control the land on the other side of the river. But the living God will be with you and will force them out of the land when you attack. And now God is going to prove that he's powerful enough to force them out. The second reading is from Benjamin Netanyahu. This is an insoluble conflict. Because it's not about territory, it is not that you can give up a kilometer more and solve it. The root of this conflict is in an entirely different place. Until Abu Mazen recognizes Israel as a Jewish state, there will be no way to reach an agreement. The third is from Cotton Mather. The New Englanders are a people of God, settled in those which were once the devil's territories. And the story of Joshua. We reach the promised land 40 years later. The original ones who were slaves have died. The young are seasoned soldiers. There is wealth enough for everyone, and God here at our side. The people are mad with excitement. Here is what to do to take this land away from the inhabitants. Burn their villages and cities, kill their men, kill their women, consume the people utterly. God says, "Is that clear? I give you the land, but you must murder for it. You will be a nation like other nations. Your hands are going to be stained like theirs, your innocence annihilated. Keep listening, Joshua. Only to you among the nations do I also give knowledge, the secret knowledge that you are doing evil. Only to you the commandment, love ye therefore the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt, a pillar of fire to light your passage through the blank desert of history forever. This is the agreement. It is entirely clear, Joshua, said the Lord. I said it was. He then commanded me to destroy Jericho." Wow. These are not the opinions of the reader.
Yeah, you do have to give a disclaimer when you read the Bible. Okay, so how do you preach a sermon on the book of Joshua? What would a responsible sermon sound like? Well, I'm going to have some help, because I don't know. So I'm going to, as I mentioned earlier, ask for your thoughts as we conclude. I'll throw out some things and then see what you think. I think this is a hard book. We're making our way through the Bible cover to cover in 2017, and if you're visiting with us, you can find a guide I created a few years ago on the website. I'm spending Sunday worship services with a focus on each section, and today is Joshua and Judges. And these stories of the Bible are likely more influential. That's my basic point. They are more influential than we might think. We gathered here this morning are inheritors of these stories. How do you inherit something that is at least in part to our modern sensibilities morally compromised? How do we seek to understand our spiritual history, a history that provided the theological momentum for conquest without justifying it? And we don't reflect on these stories in a detached way from our own histories and our own place today. Our minds are not blank slates receiving these stories as if there's something outside of us or as if there are no geopolitical realities present at this very moment. The United States would not exist today without the influence of these stories. The modern state of Israel would not exist today without these stories as mythological anchors. We read these stories as inheritors and as shapers of our geopolitical realities. And it doesn't matter if we're religious or secular, or if we believe the stories or not, or if we identify with them in some way or not. Even if we reject them as Bronze Age fables, they still have power. The stories and the deity they champion are more alive than we may think. And that deity is wreaking havoc. Desperately, we need a vision for our nation, and it can't be a vision drafted by some rich white guys. It must be a collective and collaborative vision that arises from the dispossessed. We need a vision of how to share the land, how to live with one another, how to keep our home, our one planet Earth, in good repair for future generations. And I think a step toward that vision of who we are and where we are and how we got here are to understand our guiding myths. And that's the reason, ultimately, why Bible cover to cover. So, in that same spirit, I find a book that is fun. It was a gift to me by a church member. It's called God is Disappointed in You. Anyone heard of this? It was written by a guy from Portland, Mark Russell, cartoons by Shannon Wheeler. And this is on the back. It says, God is Disappointed in You is for people who would like to read the Bible if it would just cut to the chase. Stripped of its arcane language and interminable passages, every book of the Bible is condensed down to its core message in no more than a few pages each. Written by Mark Russell with cartoons by New Yorker cartoonist Shannon Wheeler, God is Disappointed in You is a frequently hilarious, often shocking, but always accurate retelling of the Bible, including the part selectively left out by Sunday school teachers and church sermons. Irreverent yet faithful, this book is a must-read for anyone who wants to see past the fog of religious agendas and cultural debates to discover what the Bible really says. Well, what does Joshua say? God is Disappointed in You has its own delightful summary, but here's the basic plot as I see it. Moses is dead. 120, though. That's pretty good. But Yahweh promised a piece of real estate to his chosen people. And the one inconvenience is that there are people living there already. No problem. Yahweh will lead Joshua and his band of 12 tribes, and they will kill all the people who are in the way, burn all their stuff, destroy their gods and their culture, and take the land for themselves. There is a condition. In order to live on the land without trouble from enemies, they must obey all the laws that Yahweh gave to Moses, and the most important is that Yahweh is a jealous God, and so there can be no foreign gods to share the mantle space. So Joshua leads the merry band across the Jordan River, and the first city is Jericho. And the Israelis bring down the walls by marching around them, blowing trumpets and screaming. It's a demonstration that the Israelis did not take the land. It's a gift to them from Yahweh, and that's very important. It's a gift. Yahweh instructs the people to destroy everything, kill everyone, leave nothing. I had a person come up to me in my first church when I did this Bible cover to cover, and he was mad at me. He says, "You had me read this book and with my kids. And this isn't just about people doing bad things. God tells them to kill them all." I said, "I don't know, sorry. I had to give a disclaimer." One exception of killing everyone in Jericho, they spared the life of Rahab, the helpful hooker. She assisted the Israeli spies when they were kind of scoping out the city. And Rahab gets incorporated into the family and ultimately becomes an ancestor of King David and Jesus Christ. Well, that was easy enough. The next city is Ai. And this one does not go so well. The Aites are tougher than expected, and the Israelis are defeated. Now, Joshua learns from Yahweh that Achan, one of the Israelis, took a few nice things from Jericho against the command to destroy everything. So Achan and his whole family are found out, brought to the river's edge, stoned, and then burned. Then the Israelis defeat Ai and kill everyone. Praise be. Let that be a lesson for looters. The rest of the story of Joshua is pretty much more of the same. Yahweh turns out to be quite helpful in battle by sending down hailstones at opportune times and even making the sun stand still so the Israelis have enough daylight to kill everyone. The Israelis destroy city after city until they control the land, and it is then divided among the 12 tribes. Joshua gives an impressive speech at the end, reminding everyone that Yahweh is jealous, no other gods or trouble will follow. And that's the story. Now, the next story is the book of Judges, and it's a bit different. It has them there in the land, but besieged by enemies without and within. Apparently, Joshua didn't get all of them. And so these are the stories of happen to be 12 judges. They aren't really quite judges. They're mostly people that kind of Yahweh chose at the last minute to help them out. And the basic plot is the Israelis have done bad things. They've worshipped other gods. And so the enemies have taken over. And so God raises up a judge. And the judge wipes out the bad guys. And then there's peace for a while. Ehud, that's a great story. Ehud, Eglon is the bad king. And he's really fat. And so Ehud goes in and takes a knife and stabs him. And he's so fat that his gut covers the whole blade. That's a wonderful children's story. I think that's a good one at night, good just before bedtime. Jael is another good one. She takes a big blunt instrument anyway and kills Sisera just right into the head. That finished him off. Gideon, he's the guy who threw out the lamb's skin to see if it would rain or be dry and whatever his idea was. And he had a big army, and then God whittled it down to about 300. Now, there's a whole point of the story of why God does these kinds of things and why, for example, Jericho was taken down just by yelling. It's because Yahweh wants the folks to know that they don't do it, that they aren't responsible for taking the land, that it is a gift from Yahweh to the chosen people. There's Abimelech, Gideon's son. He thinks he should become king, and so he tries that for a while and doesn't do a very good job. Then there's Samson, a lot of stories about him. He gets a big chunk of the text, and he's really just not much of a guy. He's really ethically challenged and dumb. And he gets deceived and has his hair cut, as you know that, by Delilah, and blinded. But eventually, in the last moment, he becomes the first suicide bomber. And he brings the temple down as a last thing and kills a whole bunch of Philistines. And the Philistines are important because they become the main bad guys for the next stories that we have with David. And then it ends with this awful civil war against the tribe of Benjamin after a brutal gang rape and killing. And so Judges just descends into this awful chaos of violence and anarchism. The last verse is, everyone did what was right according to their own opinion. And again, it's a setup for Samuel and the selection of a king, which will be next time. Okay, here's a question. Are these stories historically accurate or even close? Is there any evidence outside the biblical account to support any of this? And the short answer is no. And this is relatively recent scholarship since the 1950s. Israel scholars and as from Israel, as from everywhere else, has done archaeological studies. They've went through and found about 300 sites of Israeli villages and discovered that there's no evidence at all for any of Joshua's conquests. Jericho and Ai were cities that had been long abandoned before the account of Joshua comes into play. So Joshua, the book, and probably Judges 2, is likely a complete fabrication. And so that leads to the sense, well, how did they get there and how did they make these stories up? And there are lots of theories. One is that it was kind of a movement against the city-states, and so you've had this rising up of the poor, and then they ended up kind of escaping to the hills and eventually discovered their own identity and whatnot. The problem with that one, it doesn't necessarily connect it to the whole Egypt thing. Nonetheless, there is no consensus on what the origin story of Israel is because there's just really no evidence. That's just except what the Bible says. Okay. And I think that's helpful, actually, to know that it's fiction. I mean, at least to think that it is. Hey, maybe we can create a different fiction. But Joshua, as a story, has had a life of its own, much past the Bible's story. We see it most recently in the modern state of Israel. But long before that, it was a Christian story, and ultimately an American story. Stephen Paul McSloy wrote in Indian Country Today an article, "Because the Bible Tells Me So, Manifest Destiny and the American Indians." In 1823, came up with the doctrine of discovery, the Johnson-McIntosh case, and Supreme Court Justice John Marshall put it into pen. The Johnson case, I'm reading from this article, "Because the Bible Tells Me So." The Johnson case is the foundation of all United States law regarding Indians. And what it says is that by virtue of discovery, the Europeans, and by succession, the Americans, have dominion and sovereignty over native peoples, lands, and governments. The New World, on paper, was legally vacant. Title to all Indian land is thus sovereignty of the discoverer. The author writes, well, how is this justified? And in Chief Justice Marshall's words, this is going back all the way back to 1823, "The character and religion of the New World's inhabitants afforded an apology for considering them as a people over whom the superior genius of Europe might claim as an ascendancy. To leave them in possession of their country was to leave the country a wilderness." Now, he's a secular guy. This is still 1823, separation of church and state, so he couldn't be that religious. But he was religious enough to, so he kind of discounted all of that, but he ultimately brought in what the ultimate meaning was, and that is manifest destiny. Europeans, Christians, were chosen. And that foundation goes all the way back to the land of Canaan. The author, again, McSloy, "Because the Bible Tells Me So," writing as a secular judge, was careful in enshrining the discovery doctrine as the basis for United States Indian law to avoid explicitly endorsing its religious and covenantal roots, but that was all he left out. All the other ideas about vacant land, savagery, lack of civilization, heathenism, nomadic hunters without a conception of property, all were deployed to strip Indians of their rights. Americans were the new chosen people with a manifest destiny to own the continent. Okay, here we are, 2017. I wonder if Joshua might be astonished at the size of the armies of Yahweh's chosen peoples today. This is from The Nation magazine, 2015. "While there are no freestanding foreign bases permanently located in the United States, there are now around 800 U.S. bases in foreign countries." Did you get the first part of that sentence? There are no freestanding foreign bases here, but we got 800 in foreign countries. 70 years after World War II, 62 years after the Korean War, there are still 174 U.S. base sites in Germany, 113 in Japan, 83 in South Korea, and that's according to the Pentagon. Hundreds more dot the planet in around 80 countries, including Aruba and Australia, Bahrain and Bulgaria, Colombia, Kenya, Qatar, among many other places. "And although few Americans realize it," says the article, "the United States likely has more bases in foreign lands than any other people, nation, or empire in history." So the question is, why is that? And there are probably a lot of reasons that people will give me for why there needs to be all of this military presence all over the planet. But I would suggest, going back to the article in the Indian Country magazine, that how we ultimately justify this goes back to the Bible and the idea of a chosen people and a manifest destiny. We are chosen. We are exceptional. And that's why it's very difficult to hear ultimately difficult stories about America. Preachers can talk about Jesus and be heretical and all kinds of things. But I remember two churches ago, it was pretty much toast for me when one of our major members said, "Well, now you've insulted the red, white, and blue." That's the real religion of America. American nationalism and American exceptionalism. Why is that? And it goes back, I'm going to suggest, it goes back to the very biblical roots that are just in our cultural DNA. There is no more land to conquer. There are resources under the land and under the seas. The most significant resource for the American way of life is oil. We We consume about 20 million barrels a day, and we produce around 8 to 10. The rest comes from foreign countries, many in the Middle East. Now, I'm offering these series of sermons because I just think it's time to tell the truth and to seek the truth, to just be honest. We now live in a time in which our leaders lie to us and they don't even try to hide it. And I think it'd be nice to have a little honesty now and then about what it means to be an American today, what it means to inherit these stories, what it means if we are courageous enough to say maybe we ought to let go of some of these stories and write some new ones. Conjuring up enemies such as the radical Muslim in order to justify the stealing of wealth from other nations is no virtue. Do we do that? You can tell me if I do it, if I'm way off base on that. But I think it's time to close the book on Joshua and Judges, and not close it in terms of not reading it. We need to read it, and then we need to say, can this story be ours any longer? Can there be any chosen people? Could we ever reach a point and say and actually mean through our actions that all human beings are either chosen or none are? Okay, I'd like to hear your opinion, seriously, and I'm not going to talk back. I would really like to hear your thoughts on this, because I think it's a tough sermon, and I don't know if I did it any justice. I probably didn't. I probably just made people mad. But nonetheless, I'd like to hear what you think about those stories and how we deal with them. If you raise your hand and give it a shot, there's one.
These aren't my thoughts. John Dominic Crossan wrote a book called How to Read the Bible and Still Be a Christian. I recommend it, because in it, he talks about this strand of idealism and wisdom in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. And that is one strand that appears and disappears, appears and disappears. And it's the part we generally focus on when we read the Bible. We're going to have peace. We're going to love each other. We're going to take care of the widows and children. We're going to have a year of jubilee every 50 years and make everybody equal again. And it never happened.
Why?
Well, Judges, Joshua, there's this other strand that says, and God will help us kill everybody, and in the end, in the apocalypse, there'll be rivers of blood that'll be so deep for 200 miles. Oh, if you're riding a horse, it'll come clear up almost to the neck of the horse. Terribly violent stuff, awful stuff like in Joshua. And so there's this ebb and flow, and it's like every time a leader posits that we should treat blacks equally and action is taken to make that happen, then there is a sort of backlash and a backstepping, and that good is eroded and compromised. And John Dominic Crossan says, look, it's human nature. That's my takeaway. And who do we want to be? Do we want to be on the side of the guys that go in and commit genocide? Or do we want to be on the side of the guys that take in a stranger in their land and treat them like family?
All right, thank you, Larry. Others? Yeah, right next down the row.
Well, two thoughts come to mind. One is that history is always written by the victors, and I think that's just as true of the Bible as any other. The other that comes to mind, which is not in this, what are they called, chapters? Somewhere else that is familiar to you, and that is Jesus in the temple chasing out the money lenders. And I think we're well past using religion as an excuse. It's now capitalism. It's everywhere. And it's ruthless. And the extent to which we buy into that, we are fundamentally ignoring the basic lesson of chasing the money lenders out of the temple.
All right.
So I don't find a lot of surprise, nor am I very interested, frankly, in these books of the Bible. They're self-serving. I think that's obvious. And I think if people want to use them as an excuse for what they intend to do anyway, that they contribute to that purpose. Thanks.
Right behind you.
To me, it's always helpful to realize that myths are neither true nor false. They are ways of explaining things that ordinary human language cannot explain. And we either buy them or we don't buy them, but we all live by some kind of myth or another. Whether it's the myth of omnipotent Christianity or the myth of Jesus' people as the way, these are all attempts to say something that really can't be put into words. And books like Joshua are part of that myth. And some of us in our history have adopted it, some have rejected it, but it still stands that we as a people do things that Joshua was commanded to do. And that's part of our myth.
Other?
Yeah. Well, I think for me it comes down to also the core emotions of of fear, which people are terrified of being like the beggar or the poor or the lepers. And then that leads to greed because they want to be able to fix that fear. And greed leads to capitalism or whatever way to be in charge so that they make all the decisions and they can keep themselves out of that place that they're so terrified of. And if we live in fear all our lives, it will always continue. And it's like those books provide that excuse for that behavior because everybody has fear. And unless you deal with that fear, it perpetuates that cycle of let's go kill everybody, let's do all these horrible things, because that keeps us in control and in power, and then we can make the decisions so we don't have to be afraid. It doesn't work, but I think that's, to me, that's where it kind of focuses around that core.
All right, thank you.
This may not seem connected at first, but I read a very interesting article in the Washington Post this morning about extraordinarily rich people and how to talk to their children about that wealth that they will someday inherit. And it bothered me greatly, not about how they should talk to them, but about these extremely rich people who are worried that they have too much money to give to their children and that they won't handle it well and they won't appreciate it, and they're trying to instill in them the kind of values that they grew up with, and yet they have these hundreds of millions of dollars to give to their children. And one person talked about going to a campsite, a cabin, without running water and all of this, but how did they get there? On the private jet.
Thank you.
I find it interesting that, was it just this past week or maybe last weekend, where there was the marches against Sharia law? And all this conversation that Islam is somehow the root of horror and death and destruction and murdering of people that don't follow Allah. And I think, have you read the Bible? I mean, as though this were a novelty. And it's generally, it's really I mean, I can understand why a group could glom onto to the idea that they are the chosen ones, because we've all been there, and do things in that light. But it's very fascinating to me, coming from an American culture from which we have benefited so greatly from claiming ourselves as the chosen ones, and coming from a very violent history ourselves, to presume that Islam is somehow this horrible religion leading people down these horrible paths as though we are so innocent.
I'm reminded, Kathy, you reminded me of one of the great philosophers of our time, Yoda, who said, fear leads to anger, anger leads to hate, hate leads to suffering.
Any Any other thought? Should we leave it with that? We'll leave it with Yoda. All right. Thank you. Thank you for helping me with this sermon.